Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to Melinda Carver's Positive Perspectives. Positive Perspectives is no ordinary psychic talk show. Positive Perspectives is no ordinary psychic talk show because Melinda Carver is no ordinary psychic medium. You are listening to Melinda Carver, internationally known psychic and sought-after guest by radio personalities and international conference coordinators around the world. And this means listening to Melinda Carver's Positive Perspectives will give the charge of positive energy you need today. Do you need some new uncomplicated tools and easy-to-understand strategies to live a more positive life? Tonight is your night. Welcome to Positive Perspectives. Melinda Carver, extraordinarily gifted psychic medium, respected universal light minister, effective and powerful international presenter and workshop speaker, will provide you a personal positive charge no matter how negative your circumstances may be. Do you want to get positive? Live positive? Well, listen now live to psychic medium Melinda Carver. She strives to bring you, her listening audience, the best guests at the best time for you. You are listening to Melinda Carver's Positive Perspectives, and now live in studio, psychic medium Melinda Carver.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Positive Perspectives. I'm your hostess with the mostest tonight, Melinda Carver. My guest is Mark Kasich. We'll be pulling him on momentarily tonight. Here are your positive shout outs to get that positive energy pumping all around you today to get your aura glowing. Our first positive shout out goes to all the zookeepers around the world that are trying to help the animals beat the heat. They've been posting some amazing videos on YouTube recently. There was the dancing gorilla in the kiddie pool who was just having a ball and spinning around, around and around. It was a great video. Make sure you check that out. Gorilla dancing in the pool. They had just also uploaded a video today about a little baby elephant playing in another kiddie pool. So keep those animals nice and cool through the heat snap all over the country and around the world. And our next positive shout out goes to all the kids that are outside playing around the world. So many kids nowadays sit home in front of the TV or the computer and they don't budge. They don't have any movement. So for all those kids that sign up for intramural sports or are out there playing in the playgrounds or riding their bikes up and down and around, see those kids instead of yelling or complaining about the kids crying or screaming or laughing outside, you should be saying, thank God kids can still be kids in this day and age. Those are your positive shout outs tonight. If you missed an episode, you missed a lot. Check out all the great on-demand episodes featuring international best-selling authors like Dr. Stephen Farmer, Donna DeNome, George Norrie, and more right here on Positive Perspectives. We have a great catalog of shows. This is our fifth anniversary year, and we're so excited that you could be joining us today. And now for tonight's guest, Mark Kasich is the author of Caves, Huts, and Monasteries, Finding the Deeper Self Along the Footpaths of Asia. Mark is a spiritual seeker, a backpacker, and an adventurer. In his day job, he was a mechanical engineer and he studied quantum physics. Right now, he's going to share with us his odyssey as he traveled through the timeless deserts of India, the frigid Himalayas of Nepal, and the scorching Vietnamese jungles, and the culturally rich Korean mountains to talk about his surprising and sometimes terrifying adventures. Let's find out about Mark's spiritual journey through the footpaths of Asia. Please welcome Mark Kasich.
Hi, Melinda.
Hello, hi, Mark. Melinda. Thank you for coming on this evening. How are you today?
I'm doing good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. Excellent. Great. Thank you so
Excellent.
Much for coming on. I wanted to share with everyone again the title of your book one more time. You wrote Caves, Huts, and Monasteries, Finding the Deeper Self Along the Footpaths of Asia. And in your book, Mark, you spoke of this American lifestyle that you had that gave you a good life for you and your children. And you decided on a visit to India with your daughter, Maria, this was what you were going to do. You were going to seek an authentic meditation instruction throughout Asia. What made you decide
right.
to say goodbye to your life as a mechanical engineer?
Well, I was caught up in the, I would say, I would call it a treadmill, the day-to-day grind of materialism, gaining this, gaining that, working long hours, and when I'm not working, I'm trying to acquire things, I am fixing the house. It was really a hectic lifestyle, and I would seek meditation, or I had a practice about once a week, and it was very informal, and it was very irregular, but I saw benefits in it, and I saw that that was, or I believed at the time, this is a way that I can cut through and make my life more meaningful, for one thing, more relaxed and more more collected, more aware. So that's part of what drove me to take this trip, take this adventure.
And here in the United States, where you were based, and you had this once-a-week meditation, you were practicing Buddhist already before your trip to India. So were you having a difficult time finding the meditation teacher you were looking for here in the States before your trip?
I live in the Cleveland area. There are some very good teachers here. I was practicing Japanese Zen, still am, as well as other traditions. But again, I would go once a week, and the teacher was very good. And I found it like the next day I was, you know, just relaxed and it's like really focused and I found that it calmed me down and I made better decisions. My life was good for the next day until I got caught up in the rat race again, and I spent the next 6 days running the treadmill, I sometimes call it.
And when you went to India with your daughter Maria, she had a bad break in her arm. She had a fall on the steps. And when right. you packed her off on that plane and you stayed behind, what kind of thoughts were going through your head? You know, did anyone say to you, you should be with her to help her navigate coming home? And why are you still going on this backpack trip? Or were you comfortable that she would have, you know, support at home so you can continue on your spiritual odyssey?
Yeah, so early in my trip, Maria spent 3 weeks. We spent 3 weeks together for a number of reasons. And towards the end of that, she did slip and fall. Bad break in a rural area of India. And she actually had to have some surgery there, which worked out okay, but not great. So, yes, it came time. We decided right after that, we continued on. She's a trooper. We did a few more days of travel, but came time to go home. And I was uncomfortable with that, Melinda, to a pretty good degree. But Maria's a really intelligent person, and we have a strong family support at home, so I knew it would work out fine. It was just the plane ride back is long, and I knew she'd make it through that. So,
well, she was
time,
a large part.
Exciting.
Yeah, it was a large part of the first chapters of Caves, Huts, and Monasteries was your concern strumming through there, your anxiety for your daughter on this bad break, and the descriptions of having to run back and forth from the hospital to the little store to pick up the prescriptions and surgical supplies and then go back. And, you know, you could see that fatherly angst in those comments and sentences in the book. Was she
yeah.
supportive of you and your decision to leave the States for a few months to do this spiritual journey?
Yes, she was. She was. My partner Jane was. My family have been very supportive, and I've actually been back a few times since. And they've been very supportive because I think maybe they see the benefit that I'm a changed person, I think, for the better because of my practice and because of these doing a retreat in Asia like that. The family was supportive, entire family.
And Mark, when you went to India and you said, you know, when you were in Delhi and you moved along, it was really crowded and hectic and different change of life situation from your everyday American lifestyle. Was it everything you expected those first few days besides Maria's fall on the stairs? Was it everything you were expected, or was it a big culture shock as you began to start immersing yourself into the Asian cultures?
It was a culture shock, Melinda, to a fair degree. I was prepared. I knew the streets would be busy. I knew that there's cows walking down the streets and the sort. But what's really hard, especially in a city like Delhi, is the poverty. I mean, the people that are sleeping in the streets, the families, women, children on the streets, begging. If you try and offer and help one out, then almost instantly you're surrounded by 30 people that are in need. So that was hard for me to manage my entire trip, and I tried different ways of dealing with those situations and trying to be compassionate and deal with those situations at the same time.
And how hard is it to merge being out there in the everyday work field, as this mechanical engineer, and your Buddhist practice? Was there a lot of contortions going on where you had to contort yourself into, this lifestyle for, being successful in the American capitalist society, or the spiritualness of this Zen practice? How jarring was that for you to deal with on an everyday basis before your trip, Mark?
So before my trip, dealing with it on a daily basis was difficult, and it's partly my flaw. It's my mental striving that I even still have of wanting to do the best at everything I do, be very thorough, and when I take on a project, I give my 100% fullest and then some. And so I found myself, I would and still occasionally do, just work so hard and then, find myself working myself to the point where I'm just literally collapse for a couple of days. I have to lay in bed for a day or two. And I'd go through these cycles of doing that for several months, and I was just like, just couldn't, I had these episodes of some sort. So that was part of the struggle, still deal with that to some degree.
And for your trip there into Asia, the food's different, the cultures and the various countries you visited all have different nuances. Was it hard for you as an American traveling by yourself through these countries? Was it hard for you to adapt to the cultures and the people? Or did you find that you were readily embraced and helped along the way? I know the answer because I read the book, but I'm just asking you questions for those that have not read Caves, Huts, and Monasteries yet, Mark.
I in general, I've done a fair amount of traveling. I'm a lucky person to have been able to do that over the years. And so it was rather, for the most part, easy to adjust to the cultures and the foods, I find for myself, traveling internationally is mind expanding, and it opens the mind. You see different lifestyles, and you begin to realize this isn't the only way to live. you know, we like to say in this country that we have the best standard of living. And what I found was we have the best standard of comfort. We're just, our comfort levels in this country are just beyond compare. But when it comes to standard of living, I've met people, little villages in way back in India where it just takes days to get back to, and they live so simply. They have so little, and they're so happy. They have just enough to eat for the day. They work hard in the fields, but they're happy. And that's, to me, a great standard of living. It opened my eyes to that difference. That standard of living is not what we have. It's our feeling. It's our happiness. It's our positive perspective, I guess.
Yes. And when you started to feel this angst here and you began your 7-month trip over in Asia, what did you hope to pick up or experience before your trip began?
Yeah, I had a meditation practice, and I knew that I had just scratched the surface with what that practice can do for me. So I had this desire to explore my mind through meditation to really understand myself in a deeper way. And I knew from, like I said, from some of my practice and from reading and all the writings from the masters over the millennia, you know, that say what the benefits of this practice are. I knew there was that. But there was also more. There was, I wanted to understand, I had been practicing Japanese Zen, as I said, and I had at that point, Melinda, decided that I really wanted to commit more time and dive in deeper to Buddhism. It was really, I saw the value in this lifetime, the value of that. And so I wanted to explore other traditions because I hadn't been exposed to like Tibetan Buddhism and Vipassana and Pure Land meditation, Pure Land practice. There's quite a number of different Buddhist traditions, and I wanted to explore those so that in the end, when I come back to the United States, I would either say I will continue with my Japanese Zen practice or I found something better. So it was kind of that. It was kind of probing around as well.
What I found interesting in the book is that you do share the different meditation teacher techniques that you experienced in your trips, whether it was in Nepal or Vietnam or Korea or India. But one of the ones that I saw that I thought was really interesting was in your chapter on India about the village with the different temples at the foot of the mountain and how the schedule was so intimidating to you when you saw this. You woke up at 4 a.m. and at 4:30 to 5,
yeah,
you started with a walking meditation and then a sitting meditation. And that was an hour and a half of meditation before breakfast, followed by more sitting and walking meditations and a lunch and a rest, walking and sitting meditations again between lunch to dinner right before you had a Dharma talk. When you saw these hours of meditation that people were experiencing at this temple, you said in the book, that's intimidating. I count 12 and one half hours of meditation every day, and I shudder because you've never sat longer than one half hour, after which my knees and backs usually scream for relief. And look at the hour they awaken. Yeah. So in your book, you're talking in caves, huts, monasteries, this Indian temple that you were at has this day long from 4 a.m. to 10 p.m., except for a couple meal breaks, is a day of meditation. When you saw that and you were so intimidated, how did that first day go with that of all-day meditation from 4 in the morning to 10 at night?
The first day, it was hard. It was hard on the knees. And this particular practice, they're fairly, the teaching is that there's some advantages to facing your pain. Don't respond and human tendency is, oh, my knees ache, I'm going to straighten out and I'm going to move around. And so there's advantages to looking at that. And it sounds kind of strange, but you study the feelings, you study the intensity, the type of feeling, and it helps you come in touch, increase your awareness of what's going on in your body, and come in touch with, over time, over a long time, you come in touch with how you define yourself. But the first days, yeah, there's pain, there's difficulty, there was that particular tradition, they follow a practice of having two meals a day, one at 6 a.m. and one at 11 a.m., and that's it. And so that was really hard to adjust to. By the end of the day, 9 o'clock, I'm trying to sit and do some sitting meditation, shaking, I'm weak. So very difficult, but you know what? We adapt. We adapt, we learn, and we learn from it. No pain, no gain.
And did you find that immersing yourself for those first few days of your trip in India at these all-day meditation temples, does that help get you into that mindset that you needed to continue your trip? Was that what you were looking for?
It was. It was a big part of what I was looking for. I went, throughout the book, I share numerous temples that I had gone to and masters I had talked with. But that particular place in particular, which was right on the edge of India, it was actually in Nepal, right, just a mile across the border in Nepal. That particular place is very special to me. I've been back. I'll go back. And I find that practicing that intensely for long periods of time, months, it's very, very powerful for understanding self and calming the mind. Incredible.
And how did this day-long immersion into meditations help you with knowing your higher self, your soul, Mark?
I always find this a hard thing to explain because describing experiences is difficult, but I'll give it a try. In sitting meditation, you're calming the mind, you're focusing on in that particular instance, you're focusing on your breath, the way the abdomen is moving up and down as you breathe. So that's what you're focusing on. Of course, thoughts come in and out, and sometimes you get carried away in thought, and you have to catch that and come back. And you do this over and over and over every day, every week, for weeks at a time. And you begin to understand the nature of thought, which might sound silly, but it took me months and took me guidance of the teacher who we met with every day, and he keeps pointing, he and she, there were two teachers, a nun and a monk, and they keep pointing out things to look for in my meditation, things to pay attention to. And over time, you begin to realize thought isn't what I thought it was. It's you begin to associate with your thoughts in a different way, in a much different way. And it's very powerful. And it's, you realize that you're kind of mistaken for a lifetime of how you perceived your thinking. It's hard to explain, Melinda.
But do you feel that this immersion that helped you access your innermost thoughts, was it helping to refine your spirituality, your soul, to in this lifetime? Or did you feel that you had a lot more to do after those first few days? Did you feel a difference in your spirituality afterwards?
Well, I stayed at that particular place for about 3 weeks, and I had to leave because my visa was running out in Nepal, and I wanted to stay more because I was feeling really feeling the benefit of it. The teacher was a great teacher. It was a very peaceful place to be, but I was feeling the transition in myself. So yes, it definitely was very impactful, rather rapidly.
Why do you, after all this months of journeying with these different spiritual teachers and meditation teachers, and you came home and I know I'm kind of skipping around here, but that's what
I
do. For cave huts and monasteries for this meditation practice. So when you wrote this book and you're urging people that you spoke with through your journey and that who read the book now, why do you feel meditation is so important for everybody out there, everyday people who are schlepping through their days or they hate their jobs? What can meditation do for them if they can't take that 7-month trip like you were able to in Asia? How can that meditation practice help them?
I strongly encourage it. A lot of people I know will meditate 15 or 20 minutes a day. And that's great. That's just, you'll see the benefit of that. The thing with meditation, the more the better, but a little bit does good. And it does good by you increase your awareness. You become very perceptive, and you're able to see, after you've practiced for some time, you're able to see the thoughts that are starting to steer you in trouble. You're starting to see anger brewing, just like you'd see water boiling in a kettle. It's starting to boil, and you can see it coming. It's like, oh, I better tone this down before I cause myself some problems here. You see your desires earlier. Your desires of just shopping or eating or whatever, and you see where it can get you in trouble, or it can take you, into expenses that you don't need or cause problems. So it increases awareness, and I am a firm believer that if everybody practiced some degree of meditation, we would not have the wars and the misery. A lot of wars and misery that we experience as human beings, and we create it because of our desires, because of our greed, because of a number of things. When I say we, I mean, just the human species in general.
Everyone, you are listening to Mark Kasich. He is the author of Caves, Huts, and Monasteries, Finding the Deeper Self Along the Footpaths of Asia. His book, Caves, Huts, and Monasteries, is available at bookstores around the world and on Amazon. And you can go find him also on Facebook at Caves, Huts, and Monasteries, where you can find some posts from Mark on his author page. Mark, we're going to take a short pause for some station IDs. We'll be right back after these messages.
Are you having issues in your life? Do you need clarity on a situation? Get enlightened. Order your psychic reading or dream interpretation with international psychic medium Melinda Carver. Let Melinda Carver guide you through with insights already within you and around you in the spirit world next door. Order your reading today at psychicmelinda.webs.com. Psychic Melinda, MELINDA.webs.com.
Melinda receives many emails from listeners, like this one from Heather. This is why I love Melinda's show. The variety of guests and topics and conversations and information. All the hard work that's obvious that Melinda puts into every single show. The spiritual and education and growth that I've received. What a blessing, says Heather. And she adds, thank you, thank you. Thank you, Melinda Carver, psychic medium Melinda Carver on Positive Perspectives, Blog Talk Radio, and around the world. And now, Melinda is doing DVDs with Holistic Highway to Wisdom. Thanks for your emails. On behalf of Melinda Carver, thank you.
Melinda's Positive Products will help you attract positive people, events, and items into your life. These magical products can be used in your energy work, meditations, spells, and rituals. Transform your life with magic. Get positive, live positive. Order Melinda's Positive Products at psychicmelinda.webs.com. That's psychicmelinda.webs.com.
Welcome back. If you want to see me live in person, I have several appearances scheduled for the months of July and August. If you want to have a private session with me live in person, I will be at It's Your Journey in Huron, Ohio on Friday, July 7th from noon to 5:30 p.m., giving you psychic and medium readings, dream interpretations, and energy cord cuttings. I have six book signings coming up. I have It's Your Journey, also Friday, July 7th. From 6 to 8 p.m., I will be doing an author signing of my brand new book, Get Positive, Live Positive, Clearing the Negativity from Your Life. And I will be hosting that at It's Your Journey. Gives you the five variants to clear out of your life to help move out that energy so that your love life stops sucking, your family relationships improve, and your career stops going down the drain. It'll teach you the free and inexpensive tools you already have in your home, your garden, your grocery store, your new age store. And you can also come see me in July for book signings at Eileen Fisher Boutique at the Eden Collection in Woodmere, Ohio. That will be Saturday, July 15th. I will be at Goddess Blessed in Lakewood, Ohio, Thursday, July 20th for signing Get Positive, Live Positive. I will be at the Lilydale Bookstore on Saturday, July 22nd from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. Lilydale Assembly is located in Lilydale, New York. And I will be at Barnes & Noble in Fairlawn, Ohio from 3 to 5 p.m. on Saturday, July 29th. I'm back at Lilydale Assembly to teach two classes in August. They're Wednesday, August 16th, part of the Astrology Roundtable. I'm teaching Native American Lunar Calendar. I'll be doing a book signing at the bookstore at Lilydale also that day from 3 to 5. And on Wednesday, August 23rd, it will be the Lilydale Assembly. I will be teaching the Magic of the Fairies and a Fairy Walk and their Fairy Trail from 2 to 5 p.m., and the book signing is 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., and you can find that information for Lilydale Assembly at their website, lilydaleassembly.com, or go to psychicmelinda.webs.com. Our guest this evening is Mark Kasich, the author of Caves, Huts, and Monasteries, Finding the Deeper Self Along the Footpaths of Asia, available at state stores nationwide and on Amazon. Please welcome back Mr. Mark Kasich. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Melinda. Hello.
And we were talking about your meditation practice, and we've discussed some events that happened for you in India. Nepal, you learned about the march around a stupa. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, called the Kora.
That is correct, yeah.
Well, okay, good, because sometimes I mangled words. And the stupa, the march around the stupa, is walking clockwise. You chant a mantra, and you spin prayer wheels. And this is supposed to cancel negative karma from your past lives. How did this meditation practice go for you in Nepal at the foothills of the Himalayan mountains?
Yeah, Nepal has been a hub or a center for Tibetan Buddhism, and what the practices you were describing were Tibetan Buddhists. In Kathmandu, there's numerous Tibetan Buddhist monasteries. Tibetan Buddhism is just a beautiful practice. It's very rich with symbolism. So the spinning of the prayer wheels is meant to show, you know, to symbolize releasing your prayers and your wishes out to the universe and the sort. There, I spent a fair amount of time. Actually, in the book, I do a chapter on a full month that I stayed in one monastery outside of Kathmandu, and they were doing a a course. It was a month-long course on Tibetan Buddhism, and boy, what a beautiful tradition, rich with symbolism, horns and flags, prayer flags, and chants and meditation. I came from Japanese Buddhism, Japanese Zen, where very, very little symbolism and a lot of time sitting on the cushion studying the mind. And so being exposed to the Tibetan tradition was beautiful, but I didn't find that it was calling me in particular exactly to do that practice. But I fell in love with the people. I fell in love with the monks, the nuns. They're just absolutely wonderful people. So while the practice wasn't exactly, I didn't feel a calling to it, I see the result of their practice is beautiful, very peaceful, peaceful, kind and caring people, just like the Dalai Lama. I mean, there's so many people like that, so many monks and nuns.
And in Nepal, you also experienced one of their funeral ceremonies where you went to this little riverbed where they had at the base of the temple, and they were burning the bodies on the pyres. So what was that experience like, seeing that live in person?
Well, so that course that I just told you about, they spent several days talking about death and the importance of coming to face with our own death and our own destiny, and really letting it sink in that our time is limited. And someone told me in that course, they said, well, if you really want to come to grips with it, down in Kathmandu, there's a Hindu Pashupatinath, it's called, and the Hindus, when someone in family dies, they'll take the body there within hours, and they'll cremate on top of a stack of logs. And so it was recommended to just go sit there and watch, which is what I did for a couple hours. And I don't want to get gruesome, but it's just sitting there and watching a body change from your flesh to nothing over a period of an hour was very, very impactful for me. I think our society, we kind of isolate death to some degree. It's kind of hush-hush, not talked about, but coming face to face with it like that and picturing, you know, just imaging this, you know, this is my body, this is my destiny. I'm going to go through this type of, some type of demise like this. It's impactful, and it really helps. I really encourage that to people to come to grips with that, because it helps you in your daily life. It really does.
And how do you find that these meditation practices have helped in your daily life? Do you think that you have a deeper connection with your family, your wife and your children, or your coworkers now? Or do you feel, what other ways has that changed you and your day-to-day activities, Mark?
I could make a long list of things that it does, but one of the things that I've seen happen in other people and myself is it generates a level of compassion and empathy that maybe wasn't there before. You see the pain and the suffering. Meditation increases awareness and perception. And when you come to see people's suffering, and it develops this compassion and empathy, not just to people, but the dogs, the cats, to the spider on the wall, you know, instead of smashing it, he's just trying to live. He's just trying to find food. He's just trying to exist, just like I am. So, yeah, it developed a different level of compassion. It was one of the things that came out of it.
So, Mark, you feel that a meditation practice will help change people's lives by bringing them more into their own compassion and accessing their higher self in a more day-to-day basis, which will help change their life, not only for their personal life, but their community? Do you feel this living meditation, the standing, walking, the chanting, the prayers, whichever way they choose to do the meditation, can help make changes worldwide also?
Absolutely, yes. In fact, sometimes I wonder if that's not the only way. Every religion has its own contribution to the goodness of humanity. But I find that the contribution of Buddhism is this coming aware of what's going on inside you and developing that compassion and empathy. It brings about a sense of community, a sense of connectedness, a sense of we're all whole. And therefore, then the decisions we make during the day are not just necessarily, this is good for me, this is what I want, this is what made me happy. The decisions become a little more all-encompassing, I want to do this, but it's going to cause this problem or it's going to cause this pain. And it affects the way you make decisions on a day-to-day basis. I could see, I wish some of our leaders and some of our leaders in any country would practice meditation to some degree, and some do.
If it was more a part of their religious teachings, maybe. Mark, in the book, you also talk about how you came home and how that changed your relationship with Jane and how you two had to work through the change that you experienced through your 7 months in Asia and coming back to the United States. How did this 7 month meditation journey, spiritual journey, affect your relationship here with Jane?
It affected it in a positive way in a lot of ways. I mean, she's commented that I'm more calm and even, less likely to get upset or fly off at her. And I would attribute that to the meditation practice. But at the same time, the struggle that it's more my struggle, but it's as I got into meditation, I felt a calling for more. Like I wanted to devote a bigger part of my life to that. And that was, I talk about that in the book. And so there was some lure towards monkhood, to be honest with you. And I struggled with that for a while. I think I've, come to accept, my lifestyle is not a monk. But there is this, I find, difficulty in the right balance between, the practice that I want to do and a daily family life in a kind of a busy materialistic world. And so right now, that balance is established by every once in a while I do a couple month long retreat, and that has been giving me good balance. And
The quietness you learned and the self-reflection you learned on your trip, you could still experience here in the now by yourself in a separate area for 1 to 2 months, and then you come back refreshed and fully in the now in your relationships with your wife and kids and extended family and friends?
I take a few month trip to Asia every once in a while, every year and a half or so, and in similar fashion to what I did in my book. But I find that I can, bring the meditation when I'm here. I can bring that into my daily life. It's just standing in line at the grocery store. You can contact where the mind is, what's the mind doing, touch bases with that mind and understand yourself, and just it's relaxing. You can bring it into your daily life.
And let's move over to a different subject. You had an experience in Vietnam, and you met a woman called, if I hope I pronounce this right, Su Ba.
Yeah, Su Ba.
And Su Ba was a very influential person on this trip. from your conversations with her, and you two had a discussion about past lives and this current life. And a lot of people don't connect their meditative state with past lives. So how did that conversation go from learning a meditative technique to your past lives with this Sue Ba lady that you met all the way around the world?
Right. Sue Ba, I think in Vietnamese, means elder sister, but she was really a highly established meditation nun, which is really unusual in Vietnam, where like in the U.S., males dominate the clergy over there. So she was in charge of hundreds of monks, hundreds of nuns. She was really highly established and respected throughout the whole country. And just by serendipity, I ended up at her monastery and her giving me talks and letting me stay there for a period of time. And then she woke me up she had one of her monks come and wake me up at 2 a.m. one morning and said, "Sue Ba, I want to talk to you." And so I was summoned. I got my robes. You have to wear robes when you talk with the meditation master. And so she went into a long discussion, but it ended up, she said that I've known you in past lives. I have known you. This is why karma has brought you here. And I want to help you. And she gave me a number of teachings over a period of about an hour. It was very highly charged spiritual energy in that room. It was just myself and Sue Ba and one other nun, and a monk was there too. But she described in fair detail how she had known me in previous lives, and we've come together again at this point in time. So a lot of all Buddhist traditions believe in rebirth to some degree. And many of them believe that we're just a continuous series of rebirths. And they call that samsara, is the name for it. You live a life, you die, you're born again, you live a life, and you die.
And you were able to experience some of her holy relics at the monastery that you met Sue Ba in during that 2 a.m. conversation. What was that like, handling some of their holy relics at the Buddhist monastery?
It was something that is, I felt very, very privileged. I was not sure why she was doing this for me, but she brought out a silver tray with some items on the silver tray that were antiquities that date back millennia. And these are things that had been passed from generation to generation. And she brought this out and she was showing it to me and explaining the significance of these artifacts. And to me, I was deeply humbled, still am, that she brought out these artifacts that were very, very special to her, and shared them with me and let me look at these, and in the end actually gave me a gift as well. So it was really highly symbolic to me. It's very touching to me even now.
And during this practice that you had with Sue Ba, you also quoted her in your book, Caves, Huts, and Monasteries, that Sue Ba stated, "Nirvana means quietness. It means calmness. When you get pure calmness and quietness in your mind, it means nirvana. It does not mean you die. Pure calmness. Practicing meditation, chanting the sutra, and mantra purifies the mind. If you practice every day, you'll find Buddha nature inside." So when you heard this statement from Sue Ba in the middle of this amazing experience in the middle of the temple with these holy relics in front of you, how did that resonate with your soul?
you know, nirvana is something that you hear different interpretations of. And so coming from a person like Subha, who's so highly respected, and I respected her, you know, a person that doesn't have any motivation to exaggerate or to throw theories around. You know, she's telling me about what I believe are her experiences as well. It was touching. It was touching. It helped me clarify my understanding of nirvana and what the end goal is, and it helped me understand what to expect out of the practice over the long term.
And did you find that middle of the night conversation, was that one of the most moving events in Asia for you, with that conversation with Subha?
It certainly was. Certainly was, Melinda. I can't even begin to explain the atmosphere that it was in. It was in this, again, it was 2 a.m. There was, somebody was ringing a gong in the distance, a couple buildings over, and it was just so quiet, and just the three of us talking, and Subha was giving this dissertation to me as a gift to me. And I've kept in touch with Subha. I still talk with her from time to time, and her associate Huang Nu, who's still, you know, they're still over there outside in Vietnam temple. So very touching, yes.
Now, Mark,
I wrote the book, Melinda. I'm sorry. That's part of why I wrote the book, was because of these types of conversations. I wanted to share this with other people because I felt privileged and I didn't feel right that it stays with me. I need to share this with people. That was part of my motivation.
And what have readers who've read Cave Hudson Monasteries, what have they written to you, how this book has helped touch them or to change their own meditation practice?
Oh, that's funny. You should ask that question. Just 3 days ago, I got a Facebook Messenger note from somebody I don't know, who was at a coffee shop that happened to have several of my books laid out. And this was, she said, I'm at a coffee shop. I was waiting for my mom to have dental work done, and I saw this book. I thought, I'm gonna kill time and just page through this. And she said, I'm hooked. She said, I really am interested in what you're saying and what your experiences are. And I feel a calling to this, and I will finish this book. So, you know, I just get a text like that. That's why I wrote the book. I'm not making money on this. I feel there's something here that people can benefit from. And if somebody does, then I'm a happy guy that I accomplished my goals.
Everyone, you're listening to Mark Kasich, author of Caves, Huts, and Monasteries, Finding the Deeper Self Along the Footpaths of Asia. Mark, do you have any upcoming events or book signings that you'd like to share with us where people can meet you live in person?
I don't at the moment. I have them from time to time, and when I do, I put them on my Facebook page. So just like the Facebook page, Caves, Huts, and Monasteries, and you'll get updated with that. And I'm open, you know, if somebody, if one person in your audience is interested in having me talk, I give talk at different groups. So, again, it's all about sharing what I've learned.
And once again, that's on Facebook. Caves, Huts, and Monasteries is the page. Mark, I want to thank you so very much for coming on this evening.
Thank you.
It's been
thank
a fascinating
you,
trip for me to read through the book, to see Nepal, Vietnam, Korea, and India in a different way. I've had other gurus on, like Rashmi Kalani from India and Rasha, who also spent a lot of time there. So it's always very interesting to me. I want to thank you for coming on this evening and sharing your amazing journey with the listeners tonight.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Melinda. I really, really appreciate this opportunity to do this.
Well, thank you so very much, Mark. You have a beautiful evening. Mark Kasich, everyone. Again, that's Caves, Huts, and Monasteries, available at bookstores around the world and on Amazon. Our next show is this Wednesday, tomorrow night. We're going to have late night, fun night psychic readings. That's Wednesday, June 28th, 11 p.m. Eastern, 10 p.m. Central. You can call in for mini readings all show long. Our break for July 4th is next week. We return with an episode with the soul soother energy healer, Gregory Grzybowski, returns to the show Sunday, July 9th at 8 p.m. And international best-selling author and award-winning author Donna DeNome comes back, and we're going to have great conversation about 8 keys to wholeness and how you can change your life this summer. You missed an episode, you missed a lot. Make sure you follow our show on Facebook, Positive Perspectives, and we're going to close the show out with Brian Henke's song, Breathing Out and In. Great way to get your meditation practice started. Good night, everybody.
Fireflies dancing on